in Queens football coverage.
Looking for Nico Cuomo. Cuomo, my goodness! Nico Cuomo with a touchdown!
Follow us today on Instagram at CFRC Power Plays, your number one spot for rock solid football action.
Guys, gals, non-binary pals, different circles is moving. Same day, different time slot. We're now on Fridays at 9 p.m. Join me from 9 to 10 p.m. for an adventure through sound. Who knows? You might just find your next favorite song.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Good evening, it is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. It's a moment many Kingston residents have experienced more than once this winter. The snowplow finally clears your street and leaves a heavy ridge of snow across the end of your driveway. Councillor Ryan Boehm spoke to this issue in a motion he brought forward at Tuesday's City Council meeting.
We know that, you know, the defeat you feel when you're done shoveling your driveway, especially after the winter we've just had, and that snowplow comes around the corner and you're like, yay, the snowplow. And then he goes by your driveway and leaves these massive chunks that you have no hope of clearing. And you're kind of like, yay, the snowplow.
Windrows created through municipal snowplowing operations are not only a nuisance, but can also present accessibility and service challenges for residents, particularly seniors, persons with disabilities, and households with limited capacity to remove heavy or compacted snow. Several other Ontario municipalities have implemented driveway windrow clearing programs using specialized equipment with a range of service models, eligibility criteria, and funding approaches. Boehm's motion, which received unanimous support from council, will have the city examine the possibility of implementing a similar driveway windrow clearing service in Kingston.
This is more just to explore what's the actual cost of having what other municipalities have, that extra little arm that comes down and essentially just pushes that, right? So it would push it into a bank. The technology exists, other places around us do it, but we don't really understand what it would cost, how it would be implemented, and we're just lacking information. So realistically, this starts that conversation. It's going to give us the information, and then we'll be able to make better informed decisions going forward. I'm kind of in favor of it. I'd love to see this report come back. And realistically, we know that, you know, there's people with disabilities and accessibility issues. We know we have a large senior population. So, I mean, there's a lot of the community that's been asking for this quite some time. And when I started digging into it, realized there was a massive information gap on what the costs would actually be and how we could implement this. So that's basically what we're looking to have that conversation and get some better information on this.
Councillors around the horseshoe were supportive, citing what they've heard from their constituents on the issue over the years.
I have received a number of complaints from constituents who are predominantly senior citizens and concerns about accessibility. And so having seen this service been provided in other municipalities, I was more than happy to second the motion.
And I've also had some seniors like come in and approach me and contact me about, you know, it's like I've had to pay somebody three times today just to clear my driveway because the plow went by three times. And then, you know, and then it's like that the next day and then the next day. And then it ends up being where it's, you know, it's not an affordable thing to sustain. And so, yeah, I just think that this is really worth exploring, because I think this is something that would really, the quality of life for the residents would be drastically, drastically improved, especially during the winter months, and especially with a winter like we just had. So,
a lot of constituents in my district, they asked during the campaign and after the campaign why we cannot do this when other municipalities doing. And I think it's very important when you wake up 6 o'clock in the morning, you want to go to work, and you just clean your driveway. And after 10 minutes, you went to get shower, change the clothes, you came back, and then it's like a 2 feet, 3 feet high again, the snow in your driveway. And sometime you early evening or the late evening, you clean your driveway. In the morning, you came back and you see the pile up snow again, which is also frozen. And then you have to just do it, and it's take your time, and you are late from work, especially for the senior population in our city. It's very difficult. And I think it is a good idea to look into the information, and if we can implement, and that would be great for the people living in this country. It's a great service to provide them.
City staff will now prepare a report examining clearing service models and their applicability to Kingston. The report, expected by the end of the third quarter of 2026, will include a review of programs in comparable municipalities, along with an assessment of potential service delivery options for Kingston, including associated costs, operational implications, benefits, limitations, funding considerations, and impacts on the city's ability to meet minimum maintenance standards. Following on the heels of a motion discussing snow clearing, Councillor Connie Glenn brought forward another weather-related motion, this time focused on preparing for extreme heat.
So I know it seems a little extreme. We're going from snow to heat, but here we are, Canadian to the core.
Councillor Glenn introduced a motion directing staff to report back to council on options for a residential air conditioning unit program aimed at supporting vulnerable residents with medical conditions in the city of Kingston. Staff will review best practices from cities such as Toronto and Hamilton, which have run programs providing free portable air conditioners to low-income residents with health-related conditions in the past. They will also consult with Southeast Public Health, which could help determine eligibility and manage funding distribution for residents to receive units. Glenn made the case for the motion, stressing the importance of preparation as summer temperatures continue to rise.
The reason for bringing this forward, I think we've made some significant steps forward in terms of providing cooling. However, we're still faced with individuals who suffer extreme circumstances in the heat. In 2018, a heat wave sent 13 people to the hospital. And this is something that we're likely to see continue if we don't provide help to those who cannot help themselves in this instance. So the motion is directed very specifically for people who cannot afford their own air conditioning units, for people who are challenged with medical conditions. Now what we're basically saying is, let's have staff and let's have public health go away and come back to us with a solid recommendation that would support the people most in need. So also coming out of our climate change adaptation plan, I note that there was mention of the vast increase in the number of days of 30 plus temperatures, and that this is a general upward trajectory. So this is not an issue that is going away. I want to note a couple of other things there too. July of 2024 was the warmest month on record so far. That wasn't that long ago. So we're not seeing a change in this overall pattern, and we know that it's only going to continue to get worse at the rate that we're seeing the change happen.
Heat response has been an ongoing conversation in council chambers. In winter 2025, council approved a motion establishing a maximum indoor temperature of 26 degrees Celsius for residential units equipped with air conditioning during the summer. However, that motion was not extended to units without air conditioning already installed, due to pushback from property owners and concerns about the legality of such a requirement. While landlords in Ontario are required to provide heating, there is currently no similar obligation for cooling.
One of the things I do want to say, because this was brought up, this is not asking landlords to provide this. We understand the challenges with trying to mandate that. We're not about to turn around and do that at this point. This is just saying, for people who cannot do this for themselves, who are suffering from medical health conditions, let's put some sort of a solid program in place and support them, because really at the end of the day, what it's going to lead to is increased disability, increased numbers of people showing up at our ERs, and really this just speaks to the general well-being of our community, which I hope we're all concerned about.
The motion carried unanimously. Staff are expected to return to council with options by the end of April, a quick turnaround aimed at having a program in place for summer 2026. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. You are listening to your Queen's Campus Beat, Queen's Campus News here on CFRC 101.9 FM or online at cfrc.ca. I'm Henry. The Alma Mater Society is undergoing a leadership transition following the resignation of AMS President Jonna Amer, whose resignation was accepted by the Assembly earlier this month and took effect on March 9th. The resignation came after controversy surrounding the use of the presidential corporate credit card and a proposed impeachment motion from faculty society presidents. At its March 10th Assembly meeting, members voted unanimously to appoint Dryden George as interim AMS president. George had already been elected president during the 2026 AMS winter elections, where he won 51.2% of the vote, defeating candidate Alex MacArthur. The election saw a 16.1% voter turnout, with voting taking place from January 28th to January 30th. George currently serves as chair of the AMS Board of Directors, and Assembly has approved his interim appointment in order to maintain continuity in student government following Amer's departure. Under the current plan, George will step into the interim presidency on March 27th and lead the society for the remainder of the 2025-2026 executive term, which concludes on April 30th, before beginning his full elected term as president on May 1st. Speaking after the vote, George said the circumstances were not ideal, but that beginning the role earlier could help provide a smoother transition into the next academic year. Queen's University is currently gathering feedback from students about a potential change to the university timetable that could expand class scheduling into weekends and additional evening hours. According to a survey circulated in late February, the administration is considering extending teaching hours in order to better accommodate classroom shortages and enrollment pressures. The proposal has already sparked debate among students and faculty concerned about workload, commuting logistics, and the impact on extracurricular activities. The consultation process is part of a broader effort by the university to examine long-term scheduling flexibility and space constraints across campus. Administrators say the survey results will help determine whether the institution moves forward with any structural changes to the academic timetable. In government news, the university's Board of Trustees has also been discussing financial pressures affecting students. During the March 6th Board of Trustees meeting, held in Richardson Hall, trustees examined a range of student-related issues, including the impact of recent changes to the Ontario Student Assistance Program, or OSAP. The meeting also resulted in approval of an increase in residence fees, a decision that comes amid broader concerns about affordability for students across the province. Trustees emphasized the economic pressures and global instability are shaping the financial realities facing universities and students alike, and those themes dominated discussion throughout the March session. Turning now to campus events and student activism, a lecture addressing how universities navigate campus conflict was interrupted by demonstrators earlier this month. The event was organized by Queen's Center for Teaching and Learning and the Human Rights and Equity Office and opened with remarks by Principal Patrick Dean. During the opening portion of the lecture, protesters positioned themselves behind Dean and delivered their own remarks, drawing attention to ongoing tensions surrounding political expression and institutional responses to campus conflict. The incident reflects broader debates unfolding at universities across Canada and internationally over academic freedom, protest rights, and how institutions should respond to contentious political issues within campus spaces. I've been Henry with your Queen's Campus News here on CFRC 101.9 FM's Queen's Campus Beat.
The
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. We begin with Monday, March 16th. Bit of a strange day weather-wise. Projected high of 12 degrees. Feeling closer to 6, with potentially 3 to 6 centimeters of snow falling overnight as conditions drop to about minus 8 for your overnight low. Tuesday, March 17th. Very chilly day here in the city of Kingston. Listed high of minus 5, but feeling closer to minus 17 with the wind chill. It's going to be a very cold St. Patrick's Day. Bundle up if you plan on participating in the festivities. Wednesday, March 18th, daytime high of minus 1 with a feel of actually above freezing, looking closer to 3 degrees. Thursday, March 19th, daytime high of 3 degrees, but it'll feel like minus 3 thanks to the showers in the forecast. Friday, March 20th, daytime high of 4, feeling closer to 6 with cloudy conditions and a 25% chance of precipitation. Saturday, March 21st, daytime high of 3 degrees, feeling closer to minus 6 with a mix of snow and rain in the forecast. Sunday, March 22nd, daytime high of 2 degrees, feeling closer to minus 5 with a mix of sun and cloud. And then starting off next week, Monday, March 23rd, daytime high of about 0, feeling closer to minus 3, but it will be sunny. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. As a reminder, overnight street parking restrictions have been eased as of March 1st. This means that overnight street parking is only banned when the weather conditions require it. In terms of road closures for the week, Aberdeen Street from Johnson to William is closed indefinitely to accommodate construction activity and staging in the area. The other major road closure for this week is Berry Street to Queen, which is closed indefinitely for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. That's it. That's all I have for you this week. This is Jesse Bell signing off and wishing you all safe travels.
How'd everyone's patties go? I hope everyone made it out alive. Hello, hello, happy March break. It's your girl Gigi, CFRC's newest intern, and you're listening to What's Live at 5 on CFRC 101.9 FM. Coming up on this segment, I've got K-Town's hottest concert and event calendars for the week, starting with events. To kick off March break on Monday, March 16th, enjoy $6 March break movies at the Screening Room, showtimes between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. The lineup includes The Princess Diaries, The Wizard of Oz, Monsters, Inc., Mulan, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, The Last Unicorn, and Howl's Moving Castle. Kid snack combos are $6 plus tax for a small popcorn and juice box, which is a great deal, and take it from me because I used to work at Cineplex. There will also be sensory-friendly screenings of select films. At a fantastical March break, families are invited to step into a world where ancient beliefs about the natural world shaped early ideas about health and healing. Visitors will enjoy an exclusive first look at the museum's newly renovated children's gallery, featuring brand new hands-on interactives designed especially for young explorers. Check it out at the Museum of Healthcare from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Also, don't forget about Kingstonlicious at participating restaurants until March 31st at 10 p.m. Tuesday, March 17th, happy official St. Paddy's Day. Celebrate the official holiday at the Italo-Canadian Club of Kingston for St. Paddy's Day Pasta Night. Enjoy a generous buffet featuring unlimited pasta with rich house-made bolognese and a special green pesto sauce created just for the occasion. The bar will be open all evening with beverages available for purchase, including a signature green cocktail crafted just for St. Patrick's Day. Drop in between 4:30 p.m. to 7 p.m. Improv for seniors will also be happening at the Tet Center from 2 p.m. until 4:30 p.m. But if you're not a senior, not to worry. You can check out the Level 1 Improv class at the Tet Center from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. And lastly, swing by the open mic at Musiki Cafe and Whiskey Bar at 8 p.m. until 11 p.m. On Wednesday, March 18th, explore careers with impact. Align your path with the UN Sustainable Development Goals at Gordon Hall, Room 302 at 12 p.m. In this workshop, you will apply design thinking to plan the next steps in your career, paying particular attention to ways you can have social impact in your work through the UN SDG framework. Come prepared to brainstorm, experiment with ideas, and envision possibilities. Play some board games at Something in the Water Brewing Company anytime between 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. Maybe you could try something new or meet new people. The Wonderful Women Community Choir will be gathering at Crossroads United Church at 1 p.m. until 3 p.m. No experience required and all ages welcome. Warm up your voice and head to karaoke at the Time Out Bar and Bistro at 6 p.m. But if you'd like to catch something a little later, swing by karaoke at the Mansion at 9 p.m. On Thursday, March 19th, looking to be a chemistry teacher or instructor? Check out STEAM Plus Brown Bag Seminar, a hybrid event, to investigate the ways in which chemistry education could be reimagined. For example, what is it like for a student to experience a chemistry laboratory learning environment? Or how might prompting students to create their own representations of chemistry help them explore chemical concepts? Find out the answers at Duncan MacArthur Hall Education Library at 11 a.m. The challenges of Canadian healthcare system are multifactorial. The physician role in our healthcare system, with Dr. Lisa Tannock, will focus on physician components of the complexities, including physician numbers, payment systems and structures, and practice features. Drop by at Robert Sutherland Hall, room 202 at 12 p.m. Looking for the secret to career happiness? Take a break with TED, The Secret to Career Happiness, an online workshop employee-centered experience designed to help individuals explore what truly drives their sense of fulfillment at work. Through guided reflection and open dialogue, participants gain clarity on their strengths, values, motivations, and long-term aspirations. The session offers tools to build greater meaning, engagement, and satisfaction in their careers, no matter their role or stage of professional growth. This workshop is ideal for employees at any level who want to better understand their career aspirations, refresh their energy at work, or build a stronger sense of purpose and joy in their professional life. Join Thursday at 1 p.m. Friday, March 20th marks the beginning of the weekend. Enjoy the open mic at Storrington Lions Club Hall at 5:30 p.m. Or if you're looking for a later option, swing by the open mic at the Grad Club at 7 p.m. Lastly, bring your beautiful voices to Friday night karaoke at the Buckle at 9 p.m. Don't forget those cowboy shoes. On Saturday, March 21st, Sweet Surrender, a comedy by Matthew McKeever, will take place at the Domino Theater, the Davies Foundation Auditorium at 2 p.m. To end off the week on Sunday, March 22nd, educate yourself at Stop Taking Me Off, a session to learn about why the winter season is essential to the tick life cycle and how climate change impacts our winters and affects tick biology. You'll come away with tools and techniques to protect yourself and your pets during your next outdoor adventure. Join at Elbow Lake Environmental Education Center Main Pavilion at 10 a.m. until 2 p.m. The Queen's Dance Club will be hosting their year-end recital, All of the Stars, at the Kingston Grand Theatre Rosen Auditorium at 2 p.m. and at 7 p.m. Grab your tickets before they sell out. Swing by the Memorial Centre Farmers Market at the Kingston Memorial Centre grounds at 9 a.m. until 1 p.m. for fresh foods and to show your support to local vendors. And, of course, swing by Sunday Fun Day for fun activities at the Great Lakes Museum at 10 a.m. until 1 p.m. Have an event you would like to add to our online and on-air event calendar? Reach out today via cfrc.ca or at CFRC Music on Instagram using the link tree in our bio. Next up, our concerts calendar. On Monday, March 16th, to kick off the music-filled week, we've got Canadian rock favorites, the Sheepdogs, hitting the stage at the Kingston Grand Theatre in the Rosen Auditorium. Showtime starts at 7:30 p.m. If jazz is more your thing, it's Jazz Monday, featuring Michael K. Myers and Rick Flanagan at the club at the RCHA, running 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. The live music continues with the Morning Doves performing at Musiki Cafe and Whiskey Bar from 8 p.m. until 11 p.m. And closing out the night, Rocket Surgery takes over the Toucan with their jazz and indie tunes from 9:30 p.m. all the way until 1 a.m. Tuesday, March 17th, for the St. Patrick's Day mood, we've got St. Paddy celebrations happening at the Coven with the Celtic Kitchen Party from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. At the Grand Theatre, catch Hands in Our Pockets starting at 7:30 p.m. Continuing with the St. Paddy's Day theme at my favorite, the Merchant Tap House, celebrate St. Paddy's with Doghouse and Andy Colonico, kicking things off at 8 p.m. Finally, to wrap up the night, we got Frank Ryan, a Dublin native, sharing his soulful rock music at, also my favorite, the Toucan, rocking from 9:30 p.m. until 1 a.m. Wednesday, March 18th, starting things off in the evening, Spencer Evans, who is a keyboardist, singer, entertainer, and clarinetist, is performing live at the Bank Gastro Bar from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. Next up, Christopher Jackson takes the stage at the Creekside Bar and Grill from 6 to 8 p.m., At 7:30 p.m., it's a big night at the Kingston Grand Theater as William Prince and Boy Golden bring the Further From the Country tour to the Rosen Auditorium. And wrapping up the night, Nolan and Nick perform at Musiki Cafe and Whiskey Bar from 8 to 11 p.m. On Thursday, March 19th at 6 p.m., catch Mikhail Laxton for Original Thursdays at the Coven for a night full of folk, Americana, and R&B, while Donnie Cooper hits the stage at the Creekside Bar and Grill. Then, at 7:30 p.m., Daniel James McFadden and Kieran Campbell perform live at the Broom Factory. Lastly, Friendly Rich takes over the Toucan from 9:30 p.m. to 1 a.m. Friday, March 20th, kicking off the weekend early in the afternoon, it's Honky Tonk Happy Hour at the Timeout Bar and Bistro, kicking off at 3 p.m. The live music continues at 6, with Scott Owen filling the Creekside Bar and Grill with country vibes and Wildcard hitting the stage at Timeout Bar and Bistro. At 7 p.m., Three's Company performs live at Spearhead Brewing Company, while the Crystal Shawanda Band brings blues music to the Cove Inn. Then, keep the party going with Tone Cats at the Merchant Tap House at 10:30 p.m. If you're looking for some late-night eats and live music, we've also got Jukebox County hitting the stage at the Toucan at 11 p.m. until close. On Saturday, March 21st, we start the day nice and early with the 2026 Great Bach Marathon taking place at St. George's Cathedral from 12:30 to 4:30 p.m. I know that this is a beautiful program, so make sure to drop by. At 7:30 p.m., Canadian country star Tennille Townes performs at the Kingston Grand Theatre Rosen Auditorium, joined by Tara Lightfoot. At 8 p.m., Tyler Brett Forks performs at Something in the Water Brewing Company, while Break the Night hits the stage at Timeout Bar and Bistro. And to finish your night strong, Sweet Pea and the Heat, I love that name, perform at my other favorite place, the Toucan, starting at 10:30 p.m. On Sunday, March 22nd, the Juice Box After Party featuring Tiny Horse kicks off at 2 p.m. at the Broom Factory. Into the afternoon, Ricky and the J bring the Smooth Sundays vibes with smooth soul, jazz, R&B, and pop at Musiki Cafe and Whiskey Bar at 4 p.m., while Lady and the Tramps perform at Timeout Bar and Bistro. At 8 p.m., Kai Anto performs at Musiki Cafe and Whiskey Bar, and to finish off the weekend, Two Time and Doghouse take the stage at the Merchant Tap House starting at 9:30 p.m. Have an event you would like to add to our online and on-air event calendar? Reach out today via cfrc.ca or at cfrcmusic on Instagram using the link tree in our bio. No matter what you're into this week, music, food, dancing, or just pretending you have your life together, I've got you covered. For more details on all these events, check out cfrc.ca or lock in right here on CFRC 101.9 FM. You're listening to Gigi on CFRC Radio, and from me to you, have the best week ever, be safe, be kind, and I'll catch you next week.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
Yo, Ellie.
Hey, Nate, what's up?
We're on the radio.
What? Like right now?
Yeah, it's on a promo from Live Sessions.
Oh, yeah, CFRC Live Sessions, Thursdays at 11 a.m.
Listen to sexy bands play live on air and hear exclusive interview highlights.
Sounds awesome. Tune in on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Lit. Okay, peace out, dude.
See you Thursday.
We'll start with some general ways to turn ugly duckling emotions into swans. First.
Rock. Rock, rock, rocket.
Second.
Rock. Rock, rock, rocket.
Third. This is what one doctor suggests.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. Got a new dollar food and it's out of control.
Number 7. Now. look forward in a positive mode. Start by spending a few minutes
each Thursday at 10 p.m. listening to Bright Side of the Poo. What's it about? A way of life.
Number 10, give unto others. Reach out to those you can help or inspire. Now, it's time to flip this tape. On side two, you'll find a wonderful, calming relaxation exercise.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. This is edition 307. And on the program this week, I'm sharing a conversation with Aaron Van Zinjen, who is an analyst and writer, and recently co-authored an important book called The Sustainability Class, which I have featured on the program. On the interview that I am sharing today, I'm going to be talking with Aaron about a piece that he worked on in collaboration with Breach Media, which is called Why Canada Needs Public Grocery Stores. And this is a piece that got a lot of attention and has created a lot of conversation until now. It is about public option grocery shops, and Aaron looks at what this means for Canada, but also examples of what public food options look like from Mexico to France, and importantly highlights other examples of where publicly funded food systems are present, particularly within the prison system. And I think that this is an insightful piece that Aaron worked on. You can find it at breachmedia.ca. And I think it provides some really important context and ideas to challenging some of the crisis of affordability that a lot of people are facing today. So here is the conversation for Free City Radio.
Today in Canada, but also in many places around the world, there's an increasing struggle around the what's called the cost of living. That, of course, includes housing costs, but also just basic food necessities and accessing food at the grocery store or in other locations. In the Canadian context, there's a very tight monopoly on the market in terms of major grocery shops being controlled by a few corporations. This is common in a lot of Western contexts, but we're talking about this one, which, you know, you can kind of zoom out and see that from as an example in other places too. So Aaron, you have taken, I can imagine, quite a lot of time to produce a sort of a think piece, but in a video format in collaboration with The Breach, breachmedia.ca, I believe. Yeah, that's right. Which has sort of brought forth some of these kind of realities around inequities in terms of food staple access, but also you take it farther. You're not just naming the problem. You're thinking about collective possible alternatives like food co-ops, public grocery shops, which is a conversation a lot of media right now because of some of the proposals from Zoran Mamdani in New York. Maybe we can just first start with an introduction from you, just about you and your work, and then maybe just some, what was the sort of key reason that you sort of embarked on this discussion?
Yeah, so I'm a writer, I'm a researcher, I've written a lot on like economic policy and environmental policy. And now I work for this organization, Food Secure Canada. And in the last 2 years, we've led this campaign on food affordability. And it's become actually very interesting because when we started the campaign, food inflation was going way high. And it became maybe the number one political topic in Canada, right around when I started, there was a big boycott where people were organizing a month-long boycott of Loblaws, which is the largest supermarket chain in Canada. I think 90% of Canadians live within 10 kilometers of a Loblaws or its affiliates. Wow. So that's basically, they really hold a huge share of the market, and people are really pissed about it. And strangely, the political parties, the three big political parties, haven't really kind of broken out and proposed anything that really will change the what people are pissed about, which is the escalating, the skyrocketing food prices. Since 2020, food prices in Canada, kind of all around at the grocery store, have gone up 25%. Actually, since this year, 27%, and some items have even like doubled in price at the grocery store. So people are really hurting. And you know, housing is the other other big issue that people are worried about. But food is like something you see every day, because you go to the grocery store, you buy some food on your way to work, you shop, maybe get groceries once a week. You think about it all the time, and you get angry about it. You see that cheese has doubled in price, or that packages have shrunk, so that you're getting less of what you used to get for a higher price. So people are really pissed. And we were doing work, I was researching, writing opinion pieces on this issue, and our campaign got some interest. But it was really astounding, because when I was kind of working on this issue, people from The Breach came to me and said, do you want to write the script of a video on this? And so we put out this video a few weeks ago, and the response has been overwhelming and amazing, and kind of beyond anything that my organization has been able to do in terms of like piercing through the national conversation on this issue. So that's been very interesting, is that this video really hit a nerve. A lot of people were really into it, and then the mainstream, the establishment media, was really kind of like viscerally against it, and picked it up and tried to spend a lot of time arguing against it. So it really struck a nerve.
Well, that's probably a good sign in a lot of ways. Maybe for people who are hearing this, if you could just highlight some of the key points that you were really trying to get across. And just, you mentioned Food Secure Canada, which is a really interesting organization that's been around a long time. Good to have that context, and I encourage people hearing this to look up the group. But yeah, just for listeners, can you describe some of the key points that you were addressing in the piece that you worked on?
Yeah, so the video is called Why Canada Needs Public Grocery Stores. And that title was intended to be provocative and kind of a hook to draw people in. Because it starts, you know, imagine if you have a grocery store where prices are actually affordable and you kind of feel at home in it. How crazy of an idea is that? And then it goes on to say, why don't we have that? Describing, you know, how 80% of all Canadian grocery market share is captured by only 5 corporations. And actually, that is more concentrated than many other countries, even in the West. Like, that is a lot worse than the United States. Like, we do have a very, like, monopolized, concentrated food retail system.
80% of the market captured by 5 corporations. In Canada, this is pretty common also in terms of like cell phone carriers and other airlines, other sort of major infrastructural businesses.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a huge issue. Basically, Canada is a bit of a like monopoly state. A lot of people think of it as, you know, highly capitalistic, but the fact is that it's highly monopolistic. The state really supports a high concentration of a few companies. And And the thing is, just one Loblaws, it controls 40% of the market share. So that it really shows that there's one company that really has a lot of power. And the thing is during inflation, you know, prices go up during periods of inflation, and a lot of companies make a lot of money all down the supply chain. But it's been shown that food retail companies, these supermarket companies, have increased their prices above the average rate of inflation, yeah, and actually increased their profit margins. The profit margins have doubled, yeah, in that time, which is pretty crazy.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of what our video pointed to, is that the reason why we have these, one of the reasons why we have these high food prices, is because of this monopoly. And then it pointed to actually what are some solutions, and it pointed to used actually the example of Mexico, where you do have this public food distribution and grocery system that works very well and offers really affordable prices to poor people all across the country, in small communities, in cities, and it's a very interesting system. And just the fact alone that that exists should be proof enough to show that it's, yeah, is possible to have an alternative. And even in the video, we're not saying, you know, we need, let's say, like a Soviet-style, you know, rationing system where everyone has, you know, has to shop at the same grocery store. No, we're just saying we have to increase the competition that exists and offer an alternative, yeah, that is, you know, for people, publicly controlled, and publicly organized. And that could be at a municipal level. It could be funded by the federal government, but where towns kind of are responsible for figuring it out. And what's incredible is just the amount of support this idea got. It was really kind of profound to see that people are so excited about it. And a lot of people were in the comments were saying, you know, I've never heard of this before, it's an amazing idea. And really, a lot of the anger against this food monopoly was coming out that none of the political parties have really been addressing satisfactorily.
Well, that's a really kind of key point, which I think plays across the US-Canada border and in other contexts where, like, populist right parties are talking about the cost of living.
Yes.
And I think it's important to acknowledge that and sort of dig into the ways that those issues are brought up, but it's not really acknowledged that there are systemic shifts that need to happen.
Yeah, so it is true that, you know, the right wing is really talking about cost of living in the way that liberals, kind of the center, hasn't really done or done effectively. So in Canada, you have Pierre Poilievre, who has been kind of hammering on and on about the cost of living, how it's increased. And when he talks about the causes of that, it's really strange, because you're like, wait, this isn't really, you know, he's just basically arguing the reason why cost of living has gone up is because the liberals have pumped so much money into the economy from public spending. And then also the carbon tax has increased kind of prices all across the board. But there's no research to show that this either of those are true.
Yeah, that's an important point.
Yeah. So the causes are false, that he says. And what are his solutions are actually cutting back public funding, public institutions. Other solutions that he talks about are basically, you know, increasing lowering taxes so people have more money to spend, so cost of living isn't so much of a problem. These aren't really solutions, and I think, yeah, that's kind of why a lot of people are realizing, oh, this isn't really offering us much anything. But I think in Canada, the draw to that kind of politics is, you know, we've had 15 years of liberals now, and people are tired. Like, a lot of young people are tired and are seeing the problems in society, and they want something else, and they're angry. But the fact is that neither of the big parties in Canada are offering a real alternative. And I think that's why a video like this really caught on, and why it made the establishment so angry.
Well, just to also highlight some of the research you mentioned showing that the conservative talking points around cost of living issues, the fact that those things are false was shown to be very clear from the Canadian Centre of Policy Alternatives. They did some important work on that. Look that up. Also, Food Secure Canada, which you mentioned, look that up. Quick search, you'll find it. But it brings up these questions about infrastructure, right? And I think what I really appreciated about your video is it brings up that question of what does public infrastructure look like, right? And so, you know, an obvious thing to sort of highlight is that there's a lot of public infrastructure that is central to people's lives. Public schools, libraries, roads and transit, these are all things that are covered in a public context. Mark Carney, the Canadian Liberal PM, Prime Minister, has talked about sort of quote-unquote nation-building projects, but is attacking one of the key ones, which is the Postal Service, which is definitely a public project. So maybe you could just dig in a bit more about this idea of how some of the sort of thematics and proposals that you outlined in your video speak to the importance of developing public infrastructure, and how that also relates to questions of alternative power construction that is not driven by corporations.
Yeah, it's been kind of interesting. The number one response to the video has been, you want public grocery stores? Look at Canada Post. Look at Air Canada. See how well that's gone. Look at the healthcare. See how well that's going. But what's actually, this is actually a very worrying kind of response, and a very worrying myth, because it's those things are going very badly exactly because the government has refused to fund them in the way that they need to be funded.
Yeah.
And we know that actually, you know, that infrastructure, it does take a lot to maintain. It does take a lot of resources to keep going, but it's a lot better than the alternative. It's a lot better than, you know, having that be organized for profit, and having that be organized for, for, you know, private wealth.
Yeah.
And, you know, these same people never say something like, look at how the roads are going, because everyone kind of knows and assumes that we all need roads and we all need some kind of infrastructure. Everyone knows it would be a disaster if private companies were like designing our cities and building them, because we know that that's something that it needs to be done by a non-profit, well-organized entity. So why not? Same with schools. People aren't like, look at the schools, how bad that's going. Yeah, there's a lot of problems with schools, but no one wants schools to be for profit and private. Some people do,
yeah.
But a lot of people immediately see the problems with that. It's not a very popular policy. So it's really strange that we have all these things that are public, that we know are good when they are public, but food is never really brought up as a potential place for public infrastructure. But, you know, here we're sitting in exactly one of those places. We're sitting at the Jean Talon Market. It's a public market. There's private stalls, but there's local farmers that set up their stalls, and it's public infrastructure. There's public transit that gets people there, and it's crowded every day, every weekend. It's totally crowded because people love it. And it's one of the main attractions that bring people to visit Montreal is its markets. So yeah, I think food definitely has the potential to have more kind of public presence. And something that we talk about in the video is actually I agree with a lot of the critiques that it would be very hard to set up a public grocery store because the margins are so low. You have a really tough time competing with these big companies that work at scale. What's important to start with is actually a kind of public distribution system where you, let's say, could have warehouses and logistics connecting farmers to local markets. And now, you know, in Canada, we're increasingly funding school food, you know, bringing food to schools. Why not connect that with a public distributor? Why not get local farms, farmers to distribute to hospitals?
Sure.
So there's definitely a lot of like potential there for more infrastructure, public infrastructure, and everyone's calling for it. Farmers are calling for it. Schools are calling for it. Municipalities want better access to food infrastructure. It's just, yeah, as you said, you know, the government isn't really seeing this as part of its nation building project. What they see as nation building is, you know, pipelines and ports to export the natural resources. But there's very other way, you know, we have just one more thing is like we have a hollowing out of like rural communities who are losing their wealth and losing their people. Connecting farmers with municipalities through public food systems would be an incredible way to revitalize a lot of communities.
I'm thinking about also the fact that in New York City there's a number of public grocery stores, one near Union Station. There's a number. So in the show notes, we'll link to a piece about that, soundcloud.com/freecityradio. So even the proposals in New York City aren't coming out of nowhere. And of course, just thinking about infrastructure, I think, is so important in the sense that there's sort of this process where these sort of like more challenging questions around like future steps to collectively take are sidestepped by political forces. That includes, of course, the conservatives here or even south of the colonial borderline. Trump is talking about cost of living, or at least did a lot during the campaign, but is not doing any sort of work to, well, clearly to create any public infrastructure that would address that. In this context, even the sort of small left party, the NDP, has not really picked up this idea of creating sort of public works around food or other issues. So just maybe just on this last point, a lot of people will sort of brush away conversations about this because it seems challenging, because it seems out of the norm, because it seems different, right? I think if we were to propose libraries today, mm-hmm. as opposed to 200 years ago, people would probably say something similar, right? Yeah. So maybe we could just end on that. It's like the importance of thinking about that sort of collective work and how it's obviously not simple, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. And I really appreciated how in your piece you sort of got into some of the details about what that infrastructure could look like, including food distribution setups.
Yeah, I mean, that's some, you know, people kind of know. People know that libraries are a good thing. It's good to get free books and be able to read them for free. And people kind of accept that that's a necessary expenditure of your, you know, your municipality, that we need libraries, places to hang out, places to get knowledge, places to learn. And what's interesting is, like, if you kind of propose it as a food library, like, why don't we just have a place where you can get food at cost?
Yeah.
For a lot of people, like, they're like, what? That's crazy. And for a lot of people, something clicks. It's like, yeah, why not? And there's so many examples where that's the case. In the video, we talk about the Restos U in Paris. Basically, all university students in Paris can go to a cafeteria and get a full meal for the price of a bag of chips. Like, it's really amazing, and it works really well. Everyone's happy with it. It's not communism. It just requires a kind of infrastructure. And then something else, another example is actually our armed forces and our correctional facilities. I was looking this up. These both have public infrastructure that do procurement of local Canadian food and processing it in-house for like all the armed forces that are stationed in bases and all prisoners. Now, these aren't institutions that I support, but interestingly enough, it seems okay for those kind of large-scale public institutions, but not for everyone else, you know? So it's definitely possible. We can do this at scale. For those institutions, they figured out how to do it well and efficiently. For both of those, the average is about $5 per meal. And that includes like labor and infrastructure costs. So that's really low. Like I would be, you know, if I ask anyone, would you be interested if there's a place where you can go? You don't have to show anything. You can pay $5 just to get like a full meal that includes, you know, a drink, coffee, and a dessert, a salad, a healthy meal. Everyone, I think, would be like, yes, absolutely, I would love that. And yeah, I think it's just something that everyone supports, but it's so strange that it's so outside of our cultural imaginary. We don't think of this being a possibility. I'll just say like one last thing is, I think food is really at the core, the commodification of food is at the core of capitalism. It's at the core of the history of capitalism. Yeah. So it really is kind of the core myth of capitalism that food has to be for profit. But there's a lot of examples already in our world, in the West, all around the world, where that's not the case. And, you know, times are dire. The cost of living crisis is real, and we need solutions.
Well, thinking also just about, you mentioned this, but for a reference of people who are listening who might be interested, some people will know about this, but the sort of destruction of the framework of access to public lands in England, the occupation of the commons and sort of the privatization of agriculture by the powerful was so central to the development of industrial capitalism. The video that you talked about, Aaron, is up at breachmedia.ca?
That's right.
Okay, yes. Okay, and the organization you're working with is Food Secure Canada. Thank you so much for the conversation today.
Thank you so much. I'm really pleased to be here.
Right on. And I should also note, as Aaron mentioned, we're doing this in a public market setting. So you hear the noise of the city, but that's part of it. We're sitting outside. So thanks.
That was a conversation with author and researcher Aaron Vansijan, speaking on a recently published piece called Why Canada Needs Public Grocery Stores. You can look that up at breachmedia.ca. Thanks to Aaron for being on the program today. I'm Stefan Christoph, and this is another edition of Free City Radio. Thank you to the Social Justice Center at Concordia University for supporting this project. We broadcast weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. on CJLO, 1690 AM, also in Montreal, on Thursdays at 8 AM, on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 AM, and Fridays at 1:30 PM, on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 AM, on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 AM, on Met Radio 1280 AM in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 AM, on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Thursdays at 4:30 p.m. and on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. You can look up at our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. We're also a podcast. Just look us up. Search Free City Radio through Apple Podcasts and other mediums. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks so much for being with us, and I'll speak to you next week.